ठीक है, थैंक यू वेरी मच, वेरी हैप्पी टू विजिट हियर, आई एम थैंकफुल टू द फिजिक्स डिपार्टमेंट एंड स्पेशली मार्श एडमिकी फॉर गिविंग मी अपॉर्चुनिटी टू कम हियर. दिस टॉक विल बी क्वाइट डिफरेंट देन व्हाट यू हैव बीन हियरिंग फ्रॉम टाइम. देयर विल बी सम स्ट्रिंग्स, बट दीज आर ऑफ कोर्स रिलेटेड टू कॉस्मिक स्ट्रिंग्स. दिस इज ओके. सो what I will be reporting to you will be about some experiments which we have done. Our main idea of the these experiments are in kinless matter system, but the main motivation of these experiments is to test theories of cosmic defect formation, formation of topological defects in cosmology. I suppose most of you must be familiar with topological defects in cosmology. Depending on that, I'll go in some of the details. So I'll give a very brief outline of the early universe and how topological defects arise and what is the importance of these defects. I probably should skip this detailed explanation of topological defects. If there is any doubt or any concepts people are not clear, they can ask me, I can explain that. So I'll not go into details of explaining the concept of topological defect. Most important thing which I'll be talking about is theories of topological defect formation, because that is of biggest relevance in cosmology in the early universe. So how topological defects form and what are the theories of topological defect formation in the early universe, and whether it is possible to test these theories in laboratory experiments. In what sense one is testing these theories in laboratory experiments, that's what I would like to clarify. So the general outline of early universe and phase transitions in the early universe. Big Bang theory of the universe, normally you start with this time, this temperature, Planck stage. Very highly dense universe, very hot temperature, 10 to 32, 10 to 19 GeV, and this is the density, very early time stage. And the universe has expanded since then and cooled down to the present temperature of 3 degree Kelvin. 15 billion years age. The much has happened during this stage. The thing of relevance to my talk is the phase transition which would have happened during this evolution, and the particle physics models predict that during this time, as the universe was cooling down, several phase transitions may have happened. These are symmetry between phase transitions, and it's very similar to what happens in condensed matter system. For example, cooling of a metal leads to superconductivity phase, or cooling of ordinary liquid leads to superfluid phase. This was realized in early 80s that during these phase transitions in the early universe, many topological defects may form. This is just an extrapolation from what one sees in condensed matter systems. There are many systems which undergo phase transitions and topological defects are formed, and similar thing is found to be true in particle physics models also. The importance in the case of universe was that if there are topological defects formed, then they provide non-uniformities in the universe, and these are massive objects. I'll tell you how massive they are, these topological defects. This is contrary to what happens in condensed matter systems. So due to gravitational effects, they provide non-uniformities in the otherwise uniform universe. So these, because of gravitational instability, these non-uniformities will grow and can lead to structure formation. This was the scenario some time ago. So they were a good candidate, topological defects were a good candidate for structure formation. And in fact, they were the first detailed candidates of structure formation. There was no known source of density fluctuations until topological defects were proposed. So in fact, the structure formation was kind of a mystery until then. One had to postulate density fluctuation by hand. Topological defects provided first source of density fluctuation. Subsequently, inflation came, of course, and then now the current data with microwave background radiation is inconsistent with the models based on topological defects, with the most natural models of topological defect formation. One can probably construct very contrived models which may still be okay, but they are not certainly not natural models. And no known model has been proposed which is consistent with background radiation data. the models are, still one wouldn't say that models are completely ruled out for structure formation. What is more likely, if at all, the topological effects contribute to structure formation in the universe, they will contribute to part of it. They cannot account for the entire structure formation in the early universe, but they certainly can contribute to part of it. The important thing is that if at all the topological defects were formed in the universe, they may not be as useful as giving you entire structure formation. They will be important because they are massive objects, so they will affect the evolution of the universe in many ways. First important example was this itself, constraining particle physics models. In fact, this was the whole thing which gave rise to inflation. Now inflation induced density fluctuations are good enough for structure formation. It was realized very quickly that most natural grand unified models lead to production of magnetic monopoles, massive body monopoles, and there was no way to get rid of them. Important thing is that the particle physics model only tells you that monopoles can exist. That there are problems for cosmology was realized after a theory of formation of defects of topos by Tom Kibble. So Tom Kibble showed that he provided a lower density on magnetic monopoles. You could not have magnetic monopole less than that much density. That was the main problem. So what I'm trying to drive at is that the fact that defects can form in the early universe is one point. Second point is that how many of them are formed is very important. And that is what together these two things give you various constraints in cosmology and various effects in the evolution of the universe. Many other things have been proposed. Topological effects, if they are present, like cosmic strings, if they are present, they will affect models of electroweak baryogenesis in various ways. Some of the work we have done also on this. And that's the fact that because they induce density fluctuations, that induces consequently temperature fluctuations, and temperature fluctuations can affect the dynamics of phase transitions in a very crucial manner. So in fact, dynamics of quark hadron transition gets drastically affected by presence of topological defect. This is some work which we had done. So the important thing is that one has to understand topological effects, whether they exist, and if they exist, how can they form in the universe. The field of topological defects is highly interdisciplinary. The concepts are very similar in a general sense between condensed matter physics and particle physics. So there have been a lot of interplays of ideas between the two fields. The thing which we have focused on is, can condensed matter experiments provide a rigorous test of theory of defect formation in the early universe? First suggestion to this effect was given by Zurek in the 80s, that superfluid systems may provide test of some of the aspects of the theory of defect formation. First experiments were done in liquid crystals. I'll give you the history of a little bit what experiments were done first. The important thing to realize is that the fact that a theory which applies to cosmology also applies, some aspects also apply to condensed matter system, is not necessarily a way to get a rigorous test of the theory. Rigorous test means you really should map out the results. You should be able to rigorously say that this measurement, this number I measure here, applies to the number in cosmology. As I will describe to you, there have been many experiments done in condensed matter systems trying to probe the defect formation in cosmology. Liquid crystals is one set, helium, superfluid helium is there, superconductors is there. Many of them fall in the category of providing analogy for what's happening in cosmology, or at best examples of other systems where similar theoretical considerations apply. There is a difference between that and making a rigorous test. And what I would like to show to you is that there is a way actually to make rigorous tests of theory of defect formation. Clearly, defect formation in cosmology is beyond probe. Happened at early that era. The theories which share the same universal features, that's what we have focused on, are the way to go for testing these theories rigorously. And what we'll show is that the theories which have been proposed for defect formation in cosmology do have universal predictions. They have predictions which are non-universal also, and those are also seen in condensed matter systems. And actually, it's very striking to see those, very encouraging. That's why they're some of the first experiments. But they also have some universal features. And if you focus on universal features of those theories, then the number you measure in condensed matter experiment is the same number you expect for cosmology. That's the main point. Okay, I'm skipping some part of the explanation of defects. Um, if some of you do not know what a topological defect is, I will later explain in the context of liquid crystal, a structure of a defect, so it will become more clear. Flux tubes in superconductors, people, everybody must be familiar with. What if it's in superfluid helium, everybody must be familiar with. These are examples of topological defects. So in condensed matter, there are many topological defects, as I said. Flux tubes in superconductors, what is in superfluid helium, and there are cosmic strings, magnetic monopoles, domain walls in the universe. They have a lot of common features and they have a lot of differences. Common features is the underlying theory of defect, underlying characterization of defect, which is intrinsically topological in nature, and features of the theory of the formation of defect. Differences are huge, obviously, just from the energy scale. Energy scale is milli-electron volt for condensed matter systems. This also falls in the category of topological objects, but one causes topological defects also. 1 GeV for skermions, baryon, and 10 to 16 GeV for other defects like cosmic strings and all that. These defects in cosmology are massive. So, for example, cosmic string has a mass density of 10 to 16 tons per centimeter, domain wall mass density 10 to 46 tons per centimeter square. These are clearly massive objects compared to whatever you know in the case of galaxy. Galaxy is only 10 to 38 tons. So micron size domain wall has mass equal to mass of a galaxy. Just it's obvious that these will have huge gravitational effects. So a theory, a particle physics theory which produces domain walls is ruled out. Produce domain walls at Guts era is ruled out observationally. This is actually a very trivial statement once we all have gone through the theories of cosmology and all that. It was not such a trivial statement. One could always ask the question, so even if particle physics models predict domain wall, why does one has to exist? Why is it that domain walls have to exist in the universe? How many domain walls should be there? So theories of defect formation tell you how many domain walls should be there. There is no way to get rid of the fact there has to be at least one domain wall in the observed horizon. That is what gives you observational constraint, not just the mass density, but the fact there must be one at least in your observed universe. So differences are huge. The dynamics of this defect is very different. These are formed in relativistic systems. The dynamics is relativistic. Typical velocity of a string is close to the speed of light, and typical velocity of a string in liquid crystal system, for example, is a few microns per second. The differences are as huge that. But now let me explain to you the theory of defect formation, and we'll see how the features seem to be completely independent of the details of the model. Until this work of Tom Kibble, the only process of defect formation during phase transition was known to be the thermal fluctuation, where defect density would be suppressed by Boltzmann factor. And that kind of number densities actually do not cause problem in the universe. Because monopoles are very heavy, if you only produce them thermally, they would not be overproduced. But Tom Kibble pointed out that there is a non-equilibrium process, which arises because of kind of a domain structure forming in the universe and which coexists with the defect formation by thermal fluctuation. These are two different processes, they coexist. Defect formation by thermal fluctuation would be suppressed, but this one becomes very unsuppressed at low temperatures. So the basic idea is the following. Let me give you an example of this is the effective potential at high temperature, this is one at low temperature, corresponding to a complex order parameter. So this is your Higgs field in condensed matter, you take order parameter as in terminology. So this is a complex order parameter, real components psi 1, psi 2, and this is the effective potential at high temperature, this is the one at low temperature. This is the example, for example, this is will be the example for superfluid or superconductor. Superfluid or superconductor do not have a first order transition, they have second order transition, but as an example I am giving you first order. It is easier to explain the theory of defect formation for a first order transition. So at high temperature, the minimum of free energy is here. So you will be here. This is psi equal to 0. That's the high temperature phase. At low temperature, you can be supercooled if you are trapped here. But then you will form bubbles of low temperature phase. Okay. So the bubbles of low temperature phase or the true vacuum will nucleate and they will grow and eventually they will convert the entire system or the universe into the low temperature phase. That's what will happen. Now, when you tunnel from here to here, you can change the magnitude depending on what's the shape of this curve. But this, where you go on this valley is undetermined because every point has the same energy here, same free energy here. So that's the order, that's the order parameter. The angle here is the order parameter for you. And this is what decides what kind of topological defect you have. This is the vacuum manifold for you. And the topology of the vacuum manifold decides what topological defect you have. With S1 in this case, so fundamental group of S1 is JV, so you know that here cosmic strings are there. String-like topological defects are there. So when you form bubbles here of low temperature phase, the inside the bubble, the magnitude of the order parameter would be decided by the shape of the free energy curve, but the choice of the phase is random. You choose one phase randomly. So this is an example of that. This is the high temperature phase, psi equal to 0 outside, and inside you have created these bubbles. By arrow orientation I am giving the direction of that phase angle, which was the order parameter. So this bubble has nothing to do with this bubble at all. So whatever angle you have this bubble was nucleated with, this one will nucleate with completely random value. This is an important realization. What happens subsequently is, as bubbles all coalesce, the more and more bubbles will form and they will coalesce, the bubble walls will disappear. What you are left with is a variation of order parameter which is of truly random nature beyond a typical bubble diameter distance. This is unavoidable. This was the main point of Kibble's theory of defect formation. During a phase transition, there is no way to achieve a uniform order parameter over entire space. Of course, this intuitively one expects that, but how much is the degree of homogeneity, what is precisely the degree of variation, is quantified in this kind of thing, that beyond a typical bubble diameter, the order parameter varies truly randomly. After that, it becomes easy to calculate the defect formation probability in this case. Defects in this case are those which correspond to variation of this angle by 2 pi, let's say, around a point. So now you can see here that as the order parameter is varying, around this point it seems to vary by 0 to 2 pi. Okay? This is an important ingredient further in theory of defect formation, that you know the order parameter in the bubble. How did you know how it varies in between the two bubbles? This is, one has to actually put this as a separate ingredient. This is postulated as a what was called a geodesic rule, as a rule. So this geodesic rule basically means that the order parameter will vary along the shortest rule on the vacuum manifold. It is intuitively expected from the considerations of gradient energy. It turns out that this issue becomes very subtle in the case of gauge theories, and especially theories where their fluctuations are dominant. This rule can be violated there. But as long as this rule is not violated, it's very easy to calculate the probability of defect formation in this case. So basically, at each bubble junction of this kind, you can calculate what the probability of defect formation, knowing that the values are random here. It's a very simple probability calculation, and you find that the probability per junction is 1/4 in two dimensions for this order parameter space. So this calculation of probability of 1/4 for, this is of course for point defect, this is two dimensional system, in three dimensions becomes a string. So probability of a point defect with the probability of 1/4 per bubble junction is a universal prediction. This is the defect density as such is not, because if I simply ask the question, what is the defect density I get, it clearly depends on what the bubble size. And bubble size crucially depends on the model. What kind of nucleation rates you have got, what kind of theory you have exactly, what is the exact form of free energy, what are the parameters, it depends on all that. So the defect density exactly is not a universal prediction, it's model dependent. But if you ask the question, what is the defect density per bubble, that is per intrinsic domain in this case, that is the universal prediction. It only depends on the topology of order parameter space and space dimensions. Now this is one point where the many of the experiments which are presently being done differ. Many of the experiments which are being done in superfluid helium and superconductors, there is no way to identify a domain. These are second order transitions, and I will go about second order. In second order transition, there is no way to see the domains. So there is no way to, you can even measure the quantity, that what's the density of defects per domain. You cannot. You can only measure absolute defect density. Then there is a whole filling part you have to do between this prediction of Kibble's mechanism and absolute defect density, but what is the relevant correlation length? And that is where the model dependence comes in, and that's why a lot of disagreement is there in the literature. So this I have told you, that here you can get the defect density very easily per domain. This was for the first order transition. But the same concepts apply for second order transition, almost exactly, except the fact that domains are, so what happens is even in second order transition, when the transition is happening, the order parameter is not correlated beyond a typical size, what's called the correlation length of fluctuations. So this is the correlation length of fluctuations, and the order parameter at the time of transition would not be correlated beyond then. Slowly the correlation grows, the correlation of alignment grows. But just around the time of transition, there is a typical distance beyond which order parameter fluctuates randomly. The differences are profound in the case of second order transition and first order transition. One thing is this, the domains are not clearly identifiable. Second thing is that the correlation domain is a kind of a loose term. Correlation length you can calculate, but correlation domain is an ambiguous term basically. It is introduced in the context of domain growth and defect formation, etc. But loosely the idea is there that there will be a region where the order parameter will be roughly correlated, and beyond that it will be uncorrelated. So the features of this defect formation theory will go through, even in that case, that's the point. Order of magnitude prediction should be okay, that's the point. For example, in the case of second order transition, the appropriate correlation, what should be the appropriate correlation length, has been undergoing a lot of debate. Zirek had proposed certain way of looking at it, and main point was that, in fact, when Kibble wrote his paper originally, then he said that the relevant correlation length should be the one at the Ginsberg temperature, because below which the fluctuations are suppressed. Subsequently, in fact, Kibble himself pointed out that in universe you never have, or even laboratory that way, you never have time to achieve equilibrium correlation length. There is always transition proceeding at certain finite rate, and second order transition go through the critical slowing down near the critical point. So that means that those factors have to be accounted for, and Zurek actually has given a detailed theory of what should be the relevant correlation length for second order transition. Yes.
So you said the universal prediction here is the probability of defect per bubble.
That's right, yeah.
So you need, what, three bubbles to see a defect? Is this the sort of intersection of some number?
So what should be the number of bubbles you will consider at the intersection? That's what you're asking, right? Three bubble or four bubble, is it?
Yeah,
it's not clear. In fact, people model these predictions based on three bubble collisions, four bubble collisions. So ultimately, for example, if you model by three bubble collision, a simple way to estimate defect formation is by forming a triangular lattice. The bubble centers sort of form a lattice, a triangular lattice would be one way to go. But if there are four bubble collisions, it should be a square lattice. The probability is different. The probability is slightly different in that case. So this is not clear whether it should be, of course, whether it should be three bubble or four bubble, whether this number depends on the model or whether this is also a universal fact. That is not clear. That is not understood, I would say. So this part is loose right now, whether it's three bubble. So one can give numbers for both cases and see whether you are around that. Later, I will show you that some of the experiments we have done, they even give the idea whether three bubble is better or four bubble is better. But that is not clear right now.
The number one quarter is for three bubbles?
Three bubble, not four. Four bubbles, it's larger probability. So now I'll tell you about the experiment. In fact, this experiment I have reported here itself in Santa Barbara, 95, I think. This was done with colleagues in Syracuse University. We have continued to do this experiment in India, and the main part of the talk will be about those experiments. I want to give you briefly what experiments have been done on this liquid crystal systems. So as I said, Zurek had suggested that you can check some of these defect formations in condensed matter systems in helium, but the first experiment came in liquid crystals. The first experiment was done by these people using the isotropic to pneumatic phase transition. I'll tell you about the defects in liquid crystals a little later. This experiment was really a pioneering experiment, very beautiful experiment. For the first time one saw whatever has been assumed of cosmic string, or whatever has been theoretically studied about cosmic strings, evolution and all those things, was exactly seen to happen, to occur in condensed matter system. Cosmic string formation, and from that then onwards leading to structure formation, there is a lot of theory behind it, a lot of how the system is supposed to evolve, it's supposed to reach and scaling solution, all that. All those are seen to really happen in these systems. You see a dense network of string forming, I'll show you some pictures later, a dense network of string forming, and they evolve seemingly into a scaling solution. However, and these people studied actually that how the string system evolves and sort of tried to make a correspondence. So it's a pioneering experiment in that sense. The crucial important point here is that they were not able to study the formation of defects in that in their system. They were only able to study the evolution of defect network. And evolution of defect networks is not universal. Absolutely not. I mean, they really know the systems are completely different. You have a relativistic system in the universe, and this is a non-relativistic system. This system is highly dissipative. Over-damped limit is what is appropriate for this case. Highly dissipative. So the evolution of this, in fact, whatever some features are very crucial for a string network to evolve in order to achieve scaling solution. Strings breaking and rejoining is the most crucial aspect of that. That aspect, whatever has been observed in condensed matter system, has no reason to hold true. Those simulations suggest that some part of it is true. No reason to hold true to that degree in cosmology. So both these experiments were highly motivating, and in the sense of providing analogy, that there are systems where similar thing happens. They do not tell you in a quantitative fashion or even rigorously something what happens in cosmology. We followed up this work by carrying out an experiment in the same system where we focused on the formation of defects. This group was not able to, I actually discussed with some of the members of the group, and they were not able to study the defect formation as such, though they wanted to, because they were using a pressure quench cell. A tiny cell in which liquid crystal sample was filled, and the transition was carried by pressure wave. And they were not able to see the early stages of the defect formation. They only saw the evolution part. We devised a system which was very simple actually, but that allowed us to focus on the early part of the evolution, early part of the phase transition. This system is very simple, and I assure you, we have tried many. You make it more complicated, it doesn't seem to work. The simple thing works very well. A simple glass slide, you put a droplet of liquid crystal, very tiny, 1 or 2 millimeters in size, the microscope, CCD camera, VCR. Heating has to be done in the most unsophisticated manner. If you do it more sophisticated, it gets in trouble, because you have more sophisticated heating stages. Of course, if you have extremely fine caliber, fine resolution heating stage, that will work, but that we didn't have. What we just simply heated it with a lamp, kept at a distance away, and so this lamp basically heats up the whole surroundings, and you simply change the temperature by moving the lamp little away. So the temperature decreases very slowly. How much decreases, we don't know, because the referees always have bothered us with what was the temperature in the system, and we always said we don't know. It doesn't matter for us. We would love to know, but we don't know, unfortunately. We never had the measuring devices of such accuracy. So, but the important point is that you control temperatures extremely accurately. It was so accurate that we were able to see the bubbles forming literally one at a time, and we could even control bubble growth by changing temperature. That allows us to literally see the string formation going step by step. How bubbles are forming, how bubbles are joining together, how strings are arriving at that stage. So we could measure the defect formation as bubbles collide, and we could measure defect formation per bubble. These are some of the pictures of that experiment, that old experiment. The black background is the high temperature phase of liquid crystal, which I haven't told you yet what it is, but it's a high temperature phase. No defects exist in this phase. These bright bubbles are the bubbles of low temperature phase where defects exist. So these bubbles form and they simply grow. And just keep watching them. And as bubbles coalesce, these are back pictures. What we did is we these things move fast. So we had to record them on VCR and take pictures directly from the TV monitor. So these bubbles grow, and then eventually you get strings. So you measure string length and you take the ratio with the bubble diameters in this case. That's all. And you repeat it for many samples and you take the average of that. Some of the some of the these things we have repeated there also. Now we have better facilities. So this is the background of isotropic phase, high temperature bubbles. And the picture I'm showing you is because you see this. This is the part which was studied by the group of Durer, Churak, and Yerke, and these people. bubbles form, coalesce, you get a dense network of string. Their first picture starts from here. They never were able to see those stages. Their first picture started from here. They studied this part. This is the part which is of biggest importance in cosmology. In cosmology, the two important things is what is the initial network? You need to know the geometry of the initial network completely in detail, because that is what sets the initial condition for what is supposed to be the scaling solution. But the fact that distribution scales, eventually there will be only one scale determining the whole network in this case, which will be the inter-string separation. So how many strings are there? Large strings versus small strings is the thing which decides what kind of structure formation you are going to get. The strings simply shrink and disappear, and eventually you get some long strings left. This is the part you see in condensed systems very easily. This is certainly very encouraging to study cosmic strings. So that was the experiment we had done in Syracuse. The density of defect we had found per bubble, it was in good agreement with the theoretical prediction.
Sorry, what is the theoretical prediction for strings? You said what it was for three-dimensional slice.
Right, so actually in this case it is this is why I didn't give. I only said it's a good agreement in this case, it's more non-trivial. You actually have to do numerical simulation. Because in this case, the defect formation happens in a thin film or liquid crystal on this droplet. So there are bubbles are forming. So it's actually you don't have an intrinsically two-dimensional system here. There are bubbles which are three-dimensional. Then strings go between the bubbles. So what we did is we took the cable mechanism theory as such and carried out a numerical simulation of exactly that geometry. That gives you how many long strings you get. So that's what we matched in this case. Okay? Yeah, it's not one fourth. There is no analytic. In this case, you cannot get, like one fourth you can get just by simple analytic thing argument. In this case, you cannot get it. You have to actually work out the geometry.
But if you had an infinite system,
it doesn't matter. The size of the system is not relevant because you are getting power bubble in this case. Infinite in XY dimension doesn't matter. The Z direction is important. You should not have more than one bubble. If you form double layers, then certainly simulation will give you a completely different result. Problem is that we had experiments in which we formed also double layer, triple layers of bubbles, but we rejected those because then string length is difficult to measure. It goes in vertical direction also. So we focused only those ones where the string was completely well focused. Our resolution in vertical direction was about the same as bubble sizes, so that's what we focused on. So as I'm saying that this is the experiment which we had done earlier. We continued with these experiments in India. The two important points where we have separated now is this case, that these experiments of defect density, those are universal prediction, it can only be done when you can identify the domains. And as I said, domains are very hard to see in most systems. Liquid crystals, you can see it. But even liquid crystals, if you do pressure quench like those people did, you don't see the domains. Superfluid helium or superconductors, no chance of seeing domains. These are second order transitions. How do you test theory of defect formation for such cases? So what we have done now is we have gone back to the theory. Theory has several predictions. It actually gives you the entire distribution itself of defects. It gives you the entire distribution, you analyze the distribution and you find out features which are universal. And what we have found is there are some other features which are universal, and there one doesn't have to identify domains. This refers to correlation between defects and anti-defects. That's what we have studied. Theory predicts very specific correlation between defects and anti-defects. Those are what we have measured now. So that requires a little bit of introduction to what topological defects are there in liquid crystals. So let me give you a very brief summary of what liquid crystals are. So liquid crystals are orientationally ordered liquids formed by elongated molecules or flat molecules. Best way to think of them is needles, actually. So these are like tiny rods. This is, say, one molecule itself. In high temperature phase, they are completely randomly oriented. They have too much energy of fluctuation, so they do not align. This is called isotropic phase. There is no orientational order in this case. But in the low temperature phase, there is the orientational ordering in local regions. So all these molecules tend to align, not exactly perfectly aligned, they tend to align in some direction. Degree of alignment depends on how far you are away from the transition temperature. So this is local alignment. The direction of alignment then becomes an order parameter, just like it was the complex vector, complex scalar in that case, which could be represented by a vector. The difference here is there is no arrowhead here in this case. These are really rods. There is no arrowhead here. So what you get, and of course these can be orientationally ordered any direction in physical space. This is very similar to what you will have for ferromagnetism. Ferromagnetism has a direction, so you represent by arrow. And we know order parameter space in that case is 2 sphere, S2. In this case, because there is no orient, there is no direction as such, you have to identify opposite directions. The order parameter space is S2 by Z2 in this case, which is RP2. The 2 sphere ferromagnetism does not allow for a string defect. Fundamental group of S2 is trivial, but fundamental group of S2 by Z2 is Z2 itself, so it allows strings. So there are string defects in this case, there are also monopole defects, but that we have not studied. So these are the string defects in liquid crystal. These dashes are denoting to me the local ordering of the molecules. Okay? And it can vary, so the local ordering of the molecule can change by pi in this case as you go around the string defect. For other cases like superfluid helium, the direction of arrow must change by 2 pi, because you can, otherwise this will be, there will be a discontinuity of pi here. But here, because opposite orientations are identified, you can have this pi defects. This is the defect corresponding to the non-trivial element in Z2. This is for a liquid crystal which is free to vary, but what happens is liquid crystals sometimes get anchored. If you take a tiny slab, if you take a droplet like we had in our case, and a carrier transition in the top layer of that, then the liquid crystal, this director, the average alignment of direction of the molecules, that is anchored at the interface of pneumatic isotropic interface. Okay? It's anchored at angle 65 degrees in the sample which we have studied. So what happens, that's important, because what happens is you do not probe the entire 2 sphere or S2 by Z2. You are stuck on a cone, on one of the circles, which is not the equator. Okay? So what happens is the whole S2 is not relevant, S2 by Z2 is not relevant for you, effectively reduces to S1 because of that anchoring. That's very crucial. So what happens is, because that anchoring in our thing, though we are dealing with S2 by Z2, we get S1 defects in our case. So the whole theory of U1 defect formation is applicable in this case. Now, as I said, the important thing for what we wanted to study is defect anti-defect correlation. Liquid crystals, there are only two systems known in nature where defect anti-defects are easy to identify. One is liquid crystals and one is superconductors. Superconductors, because there is magnetic flux associated with them, so you can notice the direction of magnetic flux. And that is some experiment which actually one should do. Now in the liquid crystal, this is known for a long time, that it's very easy to see the winding, the sense of the winding of the defect. I'll just give you some idea of this, how it's done. So this happens because NLCs are birefringent. They have two different reflective indices, depending on whether this direction of director. So these are the director, local alignment of molecules. If the electric field of the light is perpendicular or parallel to it, you have different reflective indices. That's its material. That's how this is. So suppose now there is a winding one defect here. So here this director, which gives a local alignment of the molecules, is varying by 2 pi as you go around it. This is the winding one defect in this case. It's just like a U1 cosmic string something in the sense of structure. And suppose you put this sample where you have liquid crystal in between cross polarizers. So one polarizer has this polarizing direction, another one is this. What happens is that as light passes through the bottom polarizer, this is the polarization of light you get. The light passing through these areas where the director is aligned in that direction doesn't change its polarization. It continues, which is crossed out by this cross polarizer. You get dark. In this direction, you have to decompose the light in two directions. One is this and one is this. They are different reflective indices. They travel with different velocities, so the polarization changes as you go through the sample. So this is not completely crossed out by this cross polarizer. You get a brighter region. The bottom line being this, that if you put a liquid crystal sample between cross polarizer, you get crossing of brushes corresponding to 2 pi winding. This is what you're supposed to get. Crossing of dark brushes signals you winding by 2. That just gives you whether it's winding by 2 pi. It doesn't tell you whether it's plus winding or negative winding. But the important thing is, if you rotate the sample now, there's something different. If you rotate this sample, for example, you can see nothing happens, because the direction of brushes is simply picked out by that. That doesn't change at all. Main thing is, as you rotate the direction of the sample, suppose clockwise, the direction of the director also rotates clockwise, because that's a spin, plus one winding in this case. That's why nothing changes here. If it was an empty defect, then by definition, as you rotate it clockwise, the director would change anticlockwise. It has a reverse sense of winding, by definition. That would not get cancelled by this. So in that case, if you have an empty defect and you rotate the sample between cross polarizers, the brushes will rotate. I'll show you a specific example of this thing. So this is very simple. Now you simply carry out the transition, you rotate by rotating sample, and you compare the brushes before and after rotation, and you identify the sense of winding of defects. This technique is known for largely separated defects, for known literature for a long time. This is an example of defect network you get. These are point defects with 2 pi winding, and these are the kind of brushes you get. These are the brushes. This is where you have defect. Defect or anti-defect, you don't know that. Unfortunately, such beautifully separated where defect and anti-defect are very far are not much use to us, because we are going to study the correlation of defect and anti-defect, in fact, which is quantified by an exponent, and that exponent measurement is very hard. You need very large statistics. So this kind of things are not very useful for us. I'll show you a dense network of defect and anti-defect which we have to analyze for this. So first let me tell you what prediction we are trying to measure here. So there, as I said, there, you try to identify what are the predictions which have universal nature. Density of defects, I told you, was one. Now defect anti-defect correlations. This, as you will see, cares nothing about the domains. You don't need to know about domains at all in this case. So how does it arise? If in a given region, suppose the total number of defect anti-defects is n, if defect anti-defects are uncorrelated, they have nothing to do with each other, completely random, then suppose I measure what is delta n, that is the number of defects minus number of anti-defects. Suppose I measure that in a given region, then that will be distributed about zero with width root n. It's a Poisson distribution. That's what you expect. Okay. What does Kibble mechanism predict? You see that? Kibble mechanism, I told you, predicts the following way, that you have a distribution of domains. So these are, say, bubbles for you. And defects form because order parameter randomly varies from one domain to another domain. That's how defects form. So this is, whole space is filled by domains, and suppose I just trace a loop of perimeter L. This perimeter L goes through L by R domains, where R is the typical domain size. Okay. Now, angle varies randomly from one domain to another domain, so it has some average step size. It's pi by 2 actually in this case, but because you cannot fluctuate more than pi in the direction, so it's pi. So average pi by 2 going in either direction beyond this, going through L by R number of domains, it is a random walk problem for you. In this random walk, all you want to know is, when you complete this loop, what is the net winding? The important thing, because you are dealing with topological defect, is that net winding is same as number of defects minus number of anti-defect. So you need to know the net winding. Net winding is proportional to square root of L by R, because it's a random walk problem. That's the important thing. It has nothing to do with any model. It's completely general prediction. Square root of L, that is area per one fourth, and defect density is universal in terms of L by R domains. So it directly goes to number of domains, n for one fourth. Number of defects in this. Total number of defects, anti-defects is n, proportional to area in this case. So just n, so directly you get is that delta n, the net binding, will be proportional to n to power one fourth in this case. This is in complete contrast to what you had for the case of uncorrelated defect, where the, this was n to power one half you expect. So this exponent is a very concrete prediction of theory of defect formation, which has value 1 half here, which is 1 fourth in the theory of defect formation proposed by Kibble, where it should be 1 half, there is no correlation. This is the exponent which we have measured.
L over R is the number of domains.
L over R is the number of domains through which
the
perimeter.
The
no, this is not. The area is, this is area of 1 fourth. L by R. Yeah, but this is L by R is the number of domains through which the loop is going. So that just tells you the random walk path length. How many defects are contained inside it depends on the area enclosed. So that's why you have this power difference here, 1/2 to 1/4. Okay, that's clear. So this exponent is what we have measured in the experiment. I'll first give you the result, then I'll tell you the experiment. So we just write down the scaling relation. These are my collaborators, Ratan Digal, Rajesh Shire. So we check, what we do is we observe the defect anti-defect distribution using cross polarizers, identify defects anti-defects separately, and plot distributions of this delta n for specific n. And you measure the width of those Gaussians and simply plot them log-log plot versus n, and you check this scaling relation. This C depends on the triangular lattice or a square lattice and those kind of things. But nu does not. Nu is independent of that. C contains some of these model dependence. But even C only depends on that kind of thing. But whether triangular lattice or square lattice, it doesn't depend on other model, other kind of things. So that is, this is for triangular, this is for square lattice. These numbers. Nu is 1/4 for from Kibble mechanism. This is the number we find experimentally. 0.26 plus minus 0.11. And C is this, which seems to be closer to this, but clearly errors are very large, so one wouldn't like to make that statement here.
What is the source of the uncertainty on you? Is it statistical or
a lot of... In our experiment?
Yeah.
Oh, you will see, yeah, it's statistical, absolutely. I mean, these are, this analysis is, it really requires huge amount of data, and we didn't have that much of defects to analyze. We analyze 1,000 defects still. The problem with this exponent is 1/4. So in order to get a significant value, you really have to have large n. And as you go for large n, having independent samples becomes very hard. You need to have independent samples, that's the problem. This is the experiment. It's basically the same setup which we had here in Syracuse, except that now we have a cross polarizer. And we rotate the sample. We keep rotating the sample as we record the phase transition. And when we replay it in the TV, then we take photographs before the rotation, after rotation, before rotation, after rotation. So that this is the, okay, now let me show you the pictures. So as I said, that the statistics is required, is too much here. This is the kind of network you have to analyze. This kind of network. This network is virtually, I mean, it's impractical to even think about noting the rotation of brushes of each defect in this case. You cannot do that. What we did is we devised a technique with which again we had to fight with the referee. They didn't accept our technique, but eventually they accepted. It's a very simple technique for anybody. Okay, it's a very simple technique. I'll explain what we. What we do is that we simply identify the winding or anti-winding of one of the defects in this case, which is little bit separated from others, so you can clearly see the rotation of brushes. Then after that, what we do is simply that I'll tell you here. Here you can see this one will be defect in this case. This is the direction of brush here, and you'll see the direction of brush is completely untouched here. This sample has been rotated. You see this system of defect and defect, this has been rotated here clockwise. Okay, but the brushes here emanating from the center are aligned here, whereas this one you see is aligned this way, this one is vertically aligned here, this portion of brushes. Brushes emanating from the crossing has changed orientation here compared to here, that's an anti-defect. This one from exactly from center you have to do. If you go far away, that doesn't give you anything. Exactly from center, the direction here is exactly the same. We have analyzed this on computer. So what we do is we draw an arrow here and we transfer the arrow here and see the change in the orientation. That's what we do in this case. So this is good for identifying defects and defects which are that far separated, but you don't see that. You don't keep, I mean, this doesn't help you. This is what helps you. So what we do is we identify one of the defects or anti-defects, then we simply put quads here. 1, 2, 3, 4. That's all. And then it is obvious that the quad will, this in quadrant, whichever quadrant you are in, that number will continue unless you cross a dark band. So simply by the continuity of this dark band, this quadrant numbers, you mark one of them and you simply say 1, 2, 3, 4. Now one, say this 2 will continue all the way here, 3 will continue here. This becomes 2 and 3. This becomes 2 and 3, and this being a defect, it has to be 1, 2, 3, 4. It cannot be anything else. Okay, just this technique, it becomes actually puzzle solving. It's a lot of fun also, and sometimes very interestingly, sometimes you come back from the other direction and you see not matching, numbers not matching. You go back and you find actually you have done some mistake somewhere. So, of course, it could be very dangerous also, but three of us did it sitting together. So we didn't, so there is no hanky-panky here. But it is actually turned out to be a very beautiful technique. Any dense network you can analyze very fast in this case. The referee was upset with us because I said this technique is wrong, because if I give you a square lattice kind of defect network, your technique will say they are perfectly correlated. So we said yes, I mean, our technique will say they are perfectly correlated. If you can ever get that kind of defect network, our technique will say. This certainly is not an argument against our technique. So in fact, we ultimately gave this as a proof of our technique, where we identified each defect and anti-defect separately by rotation and separately by our technique. And the results are identical. So that convinced them ultimately. So what ultimately we did is, so what you do is that you take this kind of defect network, identify segments which have about 10 defects, say, and 10 pieces. Okay? And in those 10 pieces, you count number of defects minus number of anti-defects. And you plot a histogram of that. Same thing you do for 20, same thing you do for 30. Beyond 30, we didn't have statistics to go. So you get these plots. These are the actual plots for data. These are the actual data points you get. You can see the plot of 10 is really beautifully Gaussian, because there are a lot of statistics for that. 20, 30 becomes small, 20 is barely Gaussian, 30 is really poorly a Gaussian. But we have fitted these Gaussians floating their width as well as their centers, just for the sake of, we wanted to know. And the centers are also within 0.1 or 0.2, certainly way below 1, delta n 1. So this is, so you fit simply all this, you make a completely general fit of the Gaussian, you find out the width in this case, and this fitting gives you error itself. The fitting packages give you, because this is the statistical error in this case, you get the error. With that error, you plot the log of the width of the Gaussian. So this is the width of the Gaussian there, and you want to know mu, so simply make log sigma versus log n plot. And these error bars actually come from the fitting of this thing. This is the source of the error in this case. And this is the result, experimental result. So this is one experiment which we had done. Now second experiment which we have just finished actually, put it on bulletin board, is further in that direction. How much more the theory predicts. And theory doesn't just predict the exponent, it gives you actually the spatial dependence of correlation. So that means density correlation function. So that's the next thing to do, obviously. So that's what we did. So you calculate the density correlation function. You have now a network of defects which have identified everything, defect, anti-defect. So you can just calculate all the statistics of that.
That's again universal when expressed in terms of model size?
I'll come to that, yes. That's an important point. It is universal expressed in terms of bubble size, but we want to get rid of bubble size dependence, because we want to apply the theory to the cases where you can't see the bubbles. So I'll come to that, what we do with it. We actually plotted this, that's actually contained here itself. So we just take a defect, so what we want to show to is that when you have I don't have the picture, okay, let me just say, there is a defect anti-defect correlation in this case, because you have net number of defects, so number of defects minus number of anti-defects going at n power 1/4, not as root n. What that means is that delta n net binding is more suppressed than if we for uncorrelated case. What that means is that defect and anti-defect are somehow closer together in some sense. Okay? Instead, you can argue it much more on picture, based on picture, that when you form a defect, the probability of anti-defect is larger close to it, and probability of defect is smaller close to it than the average value. So instead, that's just like fluid. See, we know that if you have a fluid, a molecule, close to it, the probability of another molecule decreases, actually. And then a little bit away, there is a peak in the molecule density. Then that peak actually suppresses the probability later, and you have oscillatory peak. In fact, that's the kind of thing we were expecting in this case also first, but when you analyze the theory in detail, it predicts only one peak. It predicts nothing beyond one domain size. That's actually almost obvious, because what happens is once you go beyond two domains, defect formation probability is calculated by knowing that what's the random, whether the order parameter is random or not in the given region. Okay. Once I have a defect here, it affects the probability in the neighborhood. But when you go two domain size, every domain by definition is random. They know nothing about this domain. So once you go beyond two domain size, this comes out very rigorously that there is absolutely no knowledge of the domain. There is no oscillatory damped peak structure here. In fact, we don't know any other condensed matter system which has that kind of structure, having only one peak and no oscillatory damped think otherwise. The important thing is, as you're asking, that this is, you expect, theory says that peak in anti-defect density at one domain separation, depletion defect density at one domain separation. That is what theory says. These are universal predictions, certainly. But the power of the technique we would like to illustrate is when you can't, don't need to be in C domains. And that you utilize the following fact, that this domain size is proportional to average defect separation, because the probability of defect separation per domain is also universal. Since probability of defect per domain is universal, you can take defect density, and this R average clearly is related to defect density, rho minus 1/2 is what it is. So once you can just take R average itself and normalize your scales, length scale, not by domain size but by R average. And you and just calculate what the theory gives you, and that's what you should expect. No need to know the domains. That's what we have done. So you measure the defect density from the experiment first. Use that to get average defect separation by root power minus 1/2. Use that to normalize your length scales completely and plot density correlation function. That's all. And the peak then is predicted precisely at, in fact, in this case of U1, is predicted as 0.6. And these are the results in this case. Here, there is a lot of noise. This is, so we are sitting at the defect and we are plotting density correlation functions of anti-defect and defect. These are the defect. This is the theoretical plot. And these oscillations, by the way, are superficial. These oscillations are there because the lattice structure of our simulations already gives the defects a little bit centered in the lattice, which it will not be generally. So if we actually let the defect float within the lattice size, then this oscillation disappear. The peak doesn't disappear, but this oscillation disappear. Peak height is dependent on how much we let the defect float. So it's not the universal thing here. Peak position is universal. Suppression here is universal, and the peak here is the most important part of the work. This is the data and this is the theory. The peak is below 1, I would just emphasize below 1 is already remarkable. Of course, this is the discrepancy between the peak positions here. And so far we have not been able to resolve it. One possibility is that if we include more data, this maybe statistical may go away. If it doesn't go away, we don't know what's happening. There really will be a disagreement between theory and experiment if this peak shift actually remains. But the main point is that this is, once you normalize with R average, it doesn't matter whether I am dealing with a micron separated strings in the condensed matter or 10 to the minus 30 centimeters in the cosmology. You normalize it, the peak position must be around 0.6. That's the theory prediction. And you get very close to it. You get about 0.48, something like that. That's where you get the peak position in this case. And another thing is that there is no evidence, of course this is too noisy data, but at least no clear evidence of a second peak in this case. No oscillatory. But that data is too noisy to say anything about that.
I mean, over time, nearby defects, I think it's going to annihilate, right?
That's right. So how does it affect, like, how does it affect these things? Two things are there. One thing is that this we have done as soon as defects have formed. We have tried to make sure that we do it as soon as defects form, but certainly some evolution happens there. So that will be cause of a worry in this case. How much error is caused by that, we don't know. One thing is, if defect anti-defects are annihilated by coalitions of domains, none of these changes. Because that simply increases the effective correlation length.
Right. But somehow you think that over short time scales, that would be some sort of tendency for nearby things to annihilate and cut off sort of to remove some of the closer pairs and push the peak outward.
Right. I mean, if the defect and anti-defect were all roughly same distance separated, then what I am saying would be true. That defect entity annihilation will simply increase correlation length. What you are saying, because the average, this average separation has some width, there is a width of in this plot there. So smaller, closer ones will collapse, will annihilate, larger would not. That certainly requires error in that. Yes. So in fact, we had tried to make sure that we record it as soon as. In all these experiments, you try to record it as quickly as. You don't want to get into the debate of the evolution of the defect network. So we try to record it exactly at that time. The defect network evolution in the beginning is very slow. It becomes faster later. Because when defects are formed, they are really diffuse and the binding between them is not that strong. Okay, so this is the conclusions that again I want to emphasize that the numbers which we have measured do provide rigorous tests of the theory of defect formation. And these are non-trivial tests. If any of these things come out different, it will actually challenge the underlying theory. the aspects of theory which are very crucial for defect network evolution are what kind of defect description you are getting. In fact, one can write down, one has different ways of producing defect networks and they will not lead to scaling solution. If most things are formed in cosmology with a small loop, you don't get a scaling solution. They just shrink away and disappear. The horizon bound which used to be taken for monopoles actually is not, should not be applied very rigorously. This can, you can get away from that if you annihilate monopoles which are close by. You can't. So the theory of defect formation as such has to be tested, and these provide rigorous tests of that. These experiments are simple in terms of experimental requirement, but again, I'm saying that you have to really be clear what you are measuring in, if you want to claim that you are measuring theory of defect function in cosmology. Okay, thank you.
These are tabletop
experiments. These are tabletop experiments, absolutely, yes.
What is it possible?
Well, just need a microscope. Because the samples are very cheap, in fact. In fact, we are trying to buy them in India, and it's very cheap. It's very embarrassing because sample costs $10 and shipping costs $90. So I feel embarrassed buying it that. I thought I'll go and pick it up myself, you know. Yeah, these are cheap samples. Very good.
Okay. And how big are the samples?
It's 1 or 2 millimeters, I mean. Yeah. It lasts a lot. I mean, the sample which I took it 7 years ago is still lasting, by the way. It was 1 cc of sample. 1 cc. If one drop is 1 millimeter, and you keep using it until it gets contaminated by the dust and all that.
In one of your figures, it looked like you had this drop, and you said that the sort of phase transition was taking place just in some thin layer of
that's
the
right,
surface.
That's right.
That's because it cools first?
It cools first, yes. The cooling is this method of achieving phase transition, which works very well in this case, and the reason we are able to see these bubbles, which other people are not able to see, is because the cooling is done on a free surface of liquid crystal by heating the entire surrounding. People are used to dealing with liquid crystals in the boundary, in the cells. And that, in fact, after we did this, the people in Syracuse tried to modernize our setup by putting it in cells and putting, and fortunately it messes up the first order transition nature of that. Because the bubble nucleation has to be done very gently. Oh, actually, I completely forgot to mention the second part of the experiment we have done in India are not by bubble nucleation. They are with the spinodal decomposition. It's a very important part. If you do bubble nucleation, bubbles will form and strings will form through them. You won't get this point network. So what happens is when we do experiment, I completely forgot, when we do the experiment, we do very gently, and sometimes you get bubble nucleation, but sometimes you see spinodal decomposition happening. The entire region, you see literally what's called large wavelength fluctuations. You see literally those fluctuations growing. And suddenly the whole thing turns into dematic phase with the entire network of defects. Those are the good ones for us. That's what we analyze.
Like that's been super cool or something?
It's super. Well, you're super cooling to spinodal point. Mm-hmm. So you want to super cool down so that barrier has become sufficiently small that a tiny fluctuation takes you over the barrier, so you roll down. And this rolling down is what is giving us this spinodal decomposition in this case.
Rolling down different lands. So why do you get?
Because you roll down different directions in different regions. This is a tiny barrier which has almost disappeared. So in this region you roll down here, this region you roll down there. In fact, what is the relevant correlation link for spinodal decomposition is an unexplored issue.
But if you said that phase spinodal decomposition referred to a second order transition, is that what the word means?
Or no. Spinodal decomposition, you have to have a first order metastable vacuum. Yes, otherwise you don't reach spinodal. Second order simply means that the order parameter, or the vacuum expectation value, simply increases as you're cooling down. Mm-hmm. Here what happens, you get trapped to the metastable point, and then barrier disappears after a while. There's something in electrophilic transition is supposed to happen. When the barrier disappears, then you roll down from there. Mm-hmm. So the order parameter grows to its stable value by roll down, and during this time, because the inverted message had there, these large wavelength fluctuations exponentially grow. This unstable point there for the growth, and that actually you see literally beautifully here. Suddenly, over the entire sample, large wavelength fluctuations seem to grow, and suddenly the whole thing appears in the pneumatic phase.
Where in the bubble thing, you have to.
Right. In bubbles case, you see it very clearly. Completely black background and tiny bright bubbles forming and slowly growing. Mm-hmm. And another thing, this crude setup actually is such a beautiful control of temperature that if we increase the lamp distance slightly, and we can make a bubble static. literally, by moving little here and there, and we can make a bubble static. Because this is a highly dissipative growth, so it's going slow anyway. But we can make a bubble static this way.
You can push it back.
We can always push it back. We do that. I mean, in fact, bubble growing, shrinking, shrinking, make it disappear. In fact, there are some beautiful pictures. What we have done is that we have, you cool it down to pneumatic phase, you have strings. And before strings can disappear, you heat it again. Maybe I can show you a picture, very beautiful picture actually. And what you find is the bubbles, you know, inhomogeneous nucleation, we have theory of that. I'll show you a picture of that. This is what is inhomogeneous nucleation of bubbles. You cool down to pneumatic phase, then you get this string here and a string like that, that's remaining. You heat it again. The bubbles form on the string first. Inhomogeneous nucleation, this is what it is. You can control these bubbles very well. It's a good system, actually, very good system done in this manner.
Any more questions, Rajiv? No, that's okay.